Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, September 13th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Smithfield Mason City plant undergoing nearly $1 million in renovations. Throughout the course of the COVID-19 pandemic in Iowa, all kinds of businesses have had to adapt to the uncertain times. Restaurants have taken out tables. Retail stores put up barriers at checkouts. Grocers shifted hours to accommodate more at-risk people. For the Smithfield Foods located in Mason City, adapting is coming with a significant price tag. According to Smithfield Foods operations manager Shane Whitenack, the meat processing facility is undergoing nearly $1 million in renovations to allow for additional social distancing. Our Mason City facility expansion is centered around renovating common spaces such as locker, screening, and office areas, Whitenack said in a statement. He then added that those updates are scheduled to be completed in mid-October. Earlier on in the pandemic, one concern for health officials was the volume of positive test cases coming from meat processing and packing plants. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, more than 200 employees tested positive for COVID-19 at a Smithfield Foods pork processing plant, which forced the facility to close for a two-week period. Because of those events, the Associated Press reported this week that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, had cited and fined Smithfield $13,494 for having employees working closely together and exposed to the coronavirus. The story also said that the OSHA report found that Smithfield did not do enough to space employees out or provide other safety measures like face coverings or physical barriers. Mark Perrone, the president of United Food and Commercial Workers, argued to the AP that the fine did not go far enough to punish a company that makes billions of dollars in a year. This so-called fine is a slap on the wrist for Smithfield and a slap in the face of the thousands of American meatpacking workers who have been putting their lives on the line to help feed America since the beginning of this pandemic, he said. For the company's part, spokeswoman Kira Lombardo said that the citation was wholly without merit. During the time that the Sioux Falls facility was having its greatest trouble, the Mason City location stayed open because spokespeople for the plant said at the time that it had not been impacted by the South Dakota closure. Smithfield wasn't alone in having such concerns. Tyson Food Plants in Waterloo and Columbus Junction had potential outbreak concerns, as did a National Beef Packing Company plant in Tama and a Prestage plant in Eagle Grove. All of those serious health concerns had to be balanced with worries about disruptions to the food chain. By just one estimate from Smithfield President and CEO Kenneth Sullivan, the Smithfield plant in Mason City represents about 4-5% of U.S. pork production. The Mason City Smithfield plant has been in operation for 42 years and employs about 300 people. Smithfield, which was owned by ConAgra Foods until 2006, produces lunch meat, smoked hams, cook and water deli hams, and turkey. It's one of 8 company facilities in Iowa. ConAgra Foods acquired the plant, then known as Armour, in 1983 from Greyhound Corp. Greyhound Corp. reopened Armour Food Company on South Eisenhower Avenue in Mason City in 1978, about 3 years after the Armour plant on the North End closed. Clear Lake readies for $3 million project off Highway 122. A $3 million economic development project that would relocate a business out of rural Cerro Gordo County has been proposed in Clear Lake. Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Flory reviewed the project and a related development agreement for sanitary sewer extension and water and sanitary sewer services with the Clear Lake City Council Tuesday evening during its meeting. I think it's a great project, and I think it has a lot of opportunity for Lot 2 to be expanded for economic development purposes there on that lot, he said. It's 5.5 acres, so I think that would work well for us. Flat Rock Group, LLC of Omaha, Nebraska, purchased nearly 11 acres north of Highway 122 and east of North 36th Place in May, according to Cerro Gordo County property records. There, it's proposed the platting of a 2-lot subdivision known as Flat Rock Subdivision. On Lot 1, located off the corner of North 36th Place and Highway 122, Flat Rock Group LLC has proposed the construction of a one-story, 14,536-square-foot, pre-engineered metal building to house Rocca, a business currently at 11332 265th Street in Mason City, according to the development agreement. About 5,671 square feet of the proposed building would be designated for offices, a conference room, a support staff area, and a showroom, while the remainder of the building would be used for service bays, parts storage, and a wash bay. The developer has selected Dean Snyder Construction of Clear Lake as its general contractor for the project. In order for the project to proceed, Flat Rock Group LLC has requested the extension of sanitary sewer mainlines improvements. The Clear Lake City Council unanimously approved the development agreement with Flat Rock Group LLC. According to the agreement, Clear Lake agrees to reimburse the developer the cost of the water and sanitary sewer laterals from the mains to the building for Lot 1 to serve the Rocca building in an amount not to exceed $14,300 for the water and $13,200 for the sanitary sewer service. Flory said the city has also proposed providing the sanitary sewer collection system extension pipe material, with the city purchasing the pipe material directly from the supplier for about $11,730. The City Council also approved a resolution that authorizing the reimbursement of funds spent from the general water and sanitary sewer funds on the capital project from the tax increment fund. Flory said the extension of sanitary sewer would not only serve the property, but additional properties in the future. Rocca is an aerial and material handling lift solutions business representing top brands of aerial work platforms, lift trucks, and warehouse equipment. There are 14 locations in the Midwest. The Cerro Gordo County location employs 13 individuals. The proposed subdivision is anticipated to go before the Clear Lake Planning and Zoning Commission later this month, and the preliminary plat is expected before the City Council on September 21st. A Clear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce groundbreaking or ribbon-cutting ceremony is scheduled for 10 a.m. September 28th at the Rocca site. Former Floyd County Attorney's license to practice suspended. A Waverly attorney who had been removed as Floyd County's top prosecutor in 2010 has been suspended again for professional conduct violations. In a decision handed down Friday, the Iowa Supreme Court suspended Jesse Marzen's license to practice for 30 days. This is Marzen's second disciplinary matter. Marzen was hired to look after the business affairs of a couple who bought and sold classic cars. That included preparing tax returns, and he was also hired to handle the estate of a relative of the couple. Court records indicate Marzen had difficulty with the tasks because of incomplete documentation submitted by his clients, and Marzen admitted he filed inaccurate tax returns because of the missing paperwork. But the Iowa Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service never received the returns for 2014 through 2016, and the couple later discovered this after they hired another attorney to handle a different matter. The Iowa Supreme Court took issue with the fact that the inaccurate returns were being used to obtain a loan. "We are most troubled by Marzen's willingness to provide knowingly inaccurate tax returns for his clients to give to their bank in support of a loan application," the High Court wrote in its ruling. Marzen was also accused of charging 18% interest on unpaid legal bills, even though the charge wasn't included in fee agreements. The Iowa Supreme Court also found that Marzen violated rules when he didn't get his client's approval when he transferred work on the estate to another law firm and then told the client the person working on the estate was a new hire at his office. Marzen had been elected to the office of county attorney for Floyd County in 2006. The county's Board of Supervisors removed him from office in 2010 after the Iowa Supreme Court found he violated ethical rules following claims he had a sexual relationship with a client while in private practice and revealed privileged information about her to reporters. Retired art professor immersed in odd Iowa history. Frank Lloyd Wright, Buffalo Bill among Barron's interests. While the COVID-19 pandemic has essentially kept Roy Barron sequestered in his home, the retired University of Northern Iowa art professor emeritus, has used the time for his own form of immersion therapy. He immerses himself in odd or surprising aspects of Iowa history and then writes and publishes essays about them. In recent months, his wide-ranging topics have included a 1912 performance by Iowa-born Buffalo Bill Cody in his Wild West show in Cedar Falls and Decorah, and architect Frank Lloyd Wright. I've been interested in Frank Lloyd Wright for a long time, particularly because I'm a designer and I admire the logic and the form and function of buildings and homes he designed. I'm especially interested in prairie style because it relates to the topography of the Midwest. Having grown up in the Midwest, I can relate to that, said Behrens. More than 20 years, the former art professor taught a UNI course on the history of modern era design. His recent book, Frank Lloyd Wright and Mason City, Architectural Heart of the Prairie, was published by the History Press and appeared on Amazon's top 10 list for nearly a year. Wright was commissioned to design the City National Bank, which also housed offices and the Park Inn Hotel at 15 West State Street. He also designed a prairie-style private home known as the Stockman House. I've visited Mason City numerous times over the years, and I can remember when the bank and hotel were in just terrible shape, just about gone, Behrens said. The architectural treasures were rescued and restored through efforts of Mason City's preservation volunteers, scholars, and the public. The world's last remaining hotel designed by Wright was reopened for guests in 2011 as the historic Park Inn Hotel after an $18 million restoration. Wright was commissioned in 1909 to design the prairie-style building. It originally opened in 1920 and closed in the 1920s, undergoing several remodels before standing vacant for years. In 2005, the Wright on the Park group was formed to save the structure. They've brought everything back in such a beautiful way, Behrens said. The restored Stockman House, completed by Wright in 1908, is now a museum. In addition, Mason City is home to the Rock Crest, Rock Glen neighborhood, described by Behrens as a cluster of prairie school houses in a scenic landscape setting that was planned by architect Walter Burley Griffin, who was a Wright associate. As recently as 2017, Condé Nast Traveler named Mason City one of its best 20 cities for architecture lovers. In a recent essay for Iowa Source magazine, Behrens drew connections between Frank Lloyd Wright, Mason City, and Australia. While lecturing in Australia, he learned that many Aussies had heard of Mason City, and some had visited the Iowa community because of its legacy of Wright-designed buildings. Behrens' interest in William Frederick Cody, or Buffalo Bill, is an outgrowth of family history. Cody was a native of LeClaire. My father actually attended one of Buffalo Bill's Wild West shows in Decorah when he was 11 years old. I went back into newspaper accounts, eyewitness reports from Cedar Falls and Waterloo and other Iowa towns, and found some very funny stories. For example, the Marshalltown Times-Republican reported that 2 months after Cody's funeral, on March 6, 1917, a group of kids had a strange encounter in Cedar Falls. For a moment, they saw walking toward them a living, breathing Buffalo Bill. This man, the same height as Buffalo Bill, had Cody's flowing hair, mustache, goatee, big sombrero, and cowboy boots, even his famous baby blue eyes. What a shock! Look, fellers, cried out one of the youngsters, Buffalo Bill ain't dead. The man turned out to be a showman, Kurt L. Alexander from Hastings, Nebraska, who was a longtime friend and body double for Buffalo Bill. He was visiting his nephew in Cedar Falls, Behrens writes. So far, the author has been fascinated by his discoveries. There really are some curious aspects about Iowa history that are worth looking into and writing about, he said. Presently, he's tracking down family history about ancestors from Manchester who became traders on the Navajo Nation in New Mexico. He expects to publish an essay on that tale as well. Sharon Randall, guest columnist. Tough times bring out the best in all of us. Sometimes when the road ahead is littered with our fears, the best we can do is to keep moving, knowing the worst may be waiting around the bend, but hoping and praying for the best. I hope you're better at that than I am. 2 weeks ago, when we saw smoke boiling over a ridge behind our house, my husband and I started packing. Wildfires move fast, and we weren't as quick as we used to be, but we were mostly concerned about breathing the smoke. Another fire had broken out not long ago, so close we could see the flames. But in minutes, air tankers were circling it, and pretty soon it was out. We felt sure this one would be too, but the smoke kept getting worse. Otter's family lives a few minutes from us. When I phoned to warn them, my son-in-law promised to be careful. So my husband and I zipped up the emergency bags we keep packed with necessities for a few days. We stood for a moment by our car, watching the smoke and praying for the firefighters. Then we left our home in their beautiful hands and drove into town to my sister-in-law's place. We took no keepsakes or other treasures. We thought we'd be back soon. We were wrong. The following day, evacuation orders were issued for several areas, including ours. The road was closed. We couldn't go back. My heart ached for all the things I wished we had taken with us, things I might never see again. Then I looked down at my wedding ring and smiled. When we left home, I almost forgot to take it. But something reminded me, and I ran back to grab it off the sink. 2 days later, my daughter and her family were evacuated and came into town to stay with us. It helped us to be together, poring over news reports, laughing at 8-year-old Henry's jokes, and trying to stay positive. Meanwhile, I wrote a column about being evacuated and began to hear from readers all around the country who emailed or posted on my website or on Facebook to say that they were thinking of us and praying for us and wishing us well. Never doubt the power of a few kind words and thoughts and prayers. To someone who is trying to silence her fears and hope for the best, they can mean the world and then some. The big break came with a change in the weather. The forecast had called for more dry lightning, the kind that had set fires throughout California. But the storm missed us, and the fog rolled in from the coast and inland through the valley. 2 days after they were evacuated, my daughter and her family and their neighbors went home. We were thrilled for them and hoped we'd be next. Crews were spread thin with hundreds of fires around the state burning over 1 million acres, but they fought hard to keep the Carmel fire from advancing to the village. We checked maps online daily and watched it inch to within 1 mile of our place, but never closer. Our neighborhood was spared. Yet, a few miles east of us, 50 homes were destroyed. Finally, 8 days after leaving home, we were cleared to go back. Carmel Valley Road is a two-lane country highway cradled by rolling mountains, dotted with horse farms and vineyards and fields of wildflowers. Rush hour traffic is a herd of mule deer and a flock of wild turkeys. Those of us who know it well like to slow down and enjoy the ride. It's especially lovely now with makeshift signs everywhere shouting, "Thanks, firefighters," from a close-knit community that feels so blessed. I wish you could see it. Tough times bring out the best in us. When tragedy strikes, a God-given goodness rises up to remind us of who we are and why we care for one another. Fear can be a hard road to travel, but when paved with grace and loving kindness, it always leads us home. John Skipper, guest columnist. Public needs to know when taxpayer money is involved. When Texas billionaire Ross Perot launched his colorful campaign for the presidency in 1992, he brought up controversial issues he said other candidates avoided. Perot said those issues were like your eccentric aunt who lives in your basement and who you try to hide, but every once in a while she climbs up the basement stairs. We don't have many of those eccentric aunts in local government and public affairs, but every once in a while one of them, government secrecy, starts climbing those stairs. That's why I'm glad Mason City Schools Superintendent Dave Versteeg and public health officials have decided to release information concerning the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on Mason City Schools, which opened recently. Secrecy seems like a harsh word in this context, but purposely withholding information can certainly be construed that way. When the nation is dealing with a pandemic that has caused nearly 200,000 deaths, the public has the right to know if the highly contagious illness is affecting the school system. I admit that my lifelong passion for the public's right to know could be construed as the eccentric aunt that lives with me. But there have been many times in recent years when the issue has come up. Clear Lake City officials successfully negotiated a deal that brought the McKesson Pharmaceutical Warehouse and Distribution Center to the city. City negotiators never divulged in advance what company they were dealing with, and the city council approved the deal without knowing the name of the company. That is use of taxpayer money without the taxpayers knowing any of the details. It turned out to be a great investment, and I'm glad. About a year later, Mason City wasn't as fortunate. Officials negotiated with the Prestige Hog processing plant to open a facility here without naming the company, and then held a press conference that included Governor Terry Branstad to announce the grand plan. But many in the public raised objections for a number of reasons, and the project was defeated by a 3-3 vote of the city council. The public's right to know often comes up in personnel matters. In 2017, then-Fire Chief Al Dyer Jr. was placed on administrative leave, a fact withheld from the public until it leaked out. When asked why Dyer was not at work, city officials declined to comment, saying it was a personnel issue. For several weeks, he was on paid leave, which means the public was paying the salary for someone who wasn't working, and yet the public did not know why. Dyer subsequently resigned. In announcing that the school system and public health officials will release information on the COVID-19 impact on the schools, Versteeg said decisions are being made on what specific data to release, how often to release it, how to best communicate it, how to protect identities, and how to be absolutely accurate, all worthy considerations. The overall principle is not whether the press has the right to be nosy, it's whether the government has the right to control what the public has the right to know, especially when taxpayers' money and/or public health and safety are involved. Letter to the editor. Democrats blame Republicans for anything, everything. Sweet it would be if Democratic leaders honored their party name. They blame Republicans for all wrong, even coronavirus. The president can do nothing proper, puts any president in a bad way. He can only tell the world of Democrats' faults. Democratic leaders want no needed wall, open borders, free for all. The world will know the United States is in favor of abortion. This coming election will tell if the United States is great or did it fall. Signed, Webster Orton, Algona. A letter to the editor. Americans can't let beloved nation be run by dictator. I don't know how many Americans would want our beloved country to become a Russian-like country run by a dictator. We will no longer be a democracy if he becomes president for another 4 years. I just wish all Fox, the propaganda network lovers, would listen to any other news network. You would realize all other networks have the same factual news. They can't all be fake news reporters. He is a criminal, along with most of his administration. His own sister and his niece pretty much say the same things. The Republican Party is now Trump's party. Sally Christensen. When Obama left office, unemployment was 4%. Under Trump, it is between 10% and 14%. Do the math. Concerning the virus, this administration knew about it back in December, and our failed leader did nothing but kept it under wrap. If he had mandated masks and social distancing, we would not have the death toll. He's rotten to the core and doesn't care about the deaths. The deaths are mostly the elderly and people of color. Wake up. He doesn't care. Most of all, he's trying to steal the election by what he's doing to the USPS. He lies every day and was fact-checked during his 70-minute RNC speech. He lied 20 times. Biden is our moral compass. We need adult leadership. Does it make you Trumpers feel good that USA is the laughingstock of the world? This great country is pitied. How does that, as an American, make you feel? It makes me angry. Signed, Karen Weber, Charles City. A letter to the editor. Uncivil war ahead if we can't get along. Some of us might very well agree that the only thing Congress has accomplished these past 4 years was to make sure that the other side didn't accomplish anything. Is that what they have been sent to do? I am deeply troubled about the dramatic division and hatred in our country. I have read, "Let not your heart be troubled." But how, with all this hate, division, and destruction all around us? I can see that you have deep convictions and differing opinions. I respect your right to have them. When I was young, studying the history of our nation, I could not understand how the Civil War could have ever have happened here in our beloved land. However, I am beginning to understand. Do you believe it is possible to live together peacefully without hate, riots, and destruction? Can we ever learn to agree to disagree? Are you willing? If not, I am afraid we are traveling down a path that could lead to another uncivil war. Signed, Bonnie Schmidt, Clear Lake. A letter to the editor. Gold old USA at stake in this election. Was very interesting to read the September 2nd guest column by former Globe editor Mr. Buttweiler. He started out by setting the stage to make us believe he is an independent. Reading the article disproves this statement, and I remember as to his editor days at the Globe, he was an independent Democrat at that time also. The heading, Time for Politics as Usual is Past, I think we can all agree as to how the three major networks and most daily papers have a rebuttal to anything President Trump has said while reporting that the protests in America are peaceful. I said reporting. No, they are not reporters, but opinion makers. The 1950s and 60s, we watched anchor newsmen as Walter Cronkite, Chet Huntley, David Brinkley, Edward R. Murrow, etc., report the event news without adding their personal additions. American government needs term limits. Mr. Trump was elected to drain the swamp. Trump was not a member of the established political crowd. Republicans, Democrats, and the media have hated him from day one as he does not march to their drumbeat. Joe Biden is mired pretty deep in this mud called the swamp, having been in politics for 40-plus years. The media and the politicians have created a dam high enough that the swamp will not be drained without term limits. This is a very important election. A left-wing Democrat government will change the America we grew up in, and the land we love will be gone forever. We are not perfect, however. Mankind from around the world desire to live in the good old USA. Signed, Wayne Retima, Kanawha. Commentary from Bill Schickel and Aaron Burnett. Bill Schickel is the mayor and Aaron Burnett is the city administrator of Mason City. This guest opinion is adapted from Mason City's All America City Award presentation. We continue to push Vision North Iowa forward. 6 months before the National Civic League named Mason City a finalist for the All America City Award, they asked about our civic infrastructure. It's not a sexy description or hot topic of conversation, but it is the backbone of the success Mason City and North Iowa are achieving. The progress and positive momentum in our community is largely a byproduct of careful and intentional planning. The biggest effort to establish our regional strategic plan, Vision North Iowa, provided the catalyst. This effort drew from the input of key partner organizations and a diverse steering committee representing wide-ranging interests. The plan identified four primary goals: building a regional community, people, place, and prosperity, innovation and entrepreneurship, and business development and marketing. It also included the strategies and actions necessary to achieve these goals. This plan was designed to be a living document demonstrating the commitment of the region to improve the lives of all North Iowans. To that end, ongoing meetings and accountability reports ensure all partners live up to the agreed-upon path in the plan. The relationships and collaboration resulting from the planning and implementation of Vision North Iowa may be the most significant byproduct. This was on display when regional leadership embarked on an inner-city visit to Dubuque to study their comeback story and find ideas that could be replicated in our region. During this trip, brainstorming on issues and potential collaboration between the partners was constant, and the regional efforts were bolstered through frank discussion and sharing. That collaboration has become the norm within our community. At long last, community leaders have come to the understanding that collectively, large challenges can be overcome through partnerships. The River City Renaissance Downtown Redevelopment Initiative is a perfect example. While the project was an articulated goal for many years, stumbling blocks and delays appeared at every turn. However, with newfound community partnership, the referendum on the project enjoyed more than 70% approval, and other obstacles have been overcome through honest communication. Local leaders hold a quick weekly huddle. This honest communication is how the daunting goal of building a new arena, hotel, conference center, performing arts pavilion, and skywalk are quickly becoming a reality. Mason City has also prospered due to people taking ownership of projects. Garden clubs have made beautiful improvements. Service clubs have improved and created new playgrounds. Leadership groups, both young and old, have implemented new experiences in our downtown. And sports associations have built new facilities and welcomed athletes from the region and state to enjoy tournaments in our community. These associations are often focused on their specific interests, but their efforts lead to benefits for the entire community: beautification, community pride, economic improvement, and higher quality of life. Our new community mantra, to work the plan to create positive outcomes, requires a commitment to action and modifying the plan as needed. The regional leadership consistently asks, are we completing the Vision North Iowa plan? This constant touchstone creates a regional alignment to the common goals and a cohesive focus to deploy our scarce resources for desired outcomes. The Vision North Iowa plan is tracked online. Progress also is reported in newsletters, public meetings, and news outlets. What it shows is more than $300 million in new investment, significant job creation, an increase in community pride, and remarkable improvement in community development initiatives. Another point of civic infrastructure is the focus on creating healthier outcomes for citizens. These efforts have been part of a large collaboration to develop new mountain and street bike trails, renewable energy facilities, increase healthy and local food availability, promote walkable neighborhoods, inclusive play areas, a new bike share program, quality affordable downtown housing options, communication on ways to incorporate healthy choices into everyday life, and healthy workplace options. The efforts are truly grassroots, with a variety of groups taking the lead in various capacities and the city serving as a resource hub to provide guidance, communication, and funding. Leadership makes all the difference. Strong, inclusive, collaborative leadership is apparent throughout the city's civic infrastructure. Our leaders understand the need for continuous development of the talent pipeline for sustainability and the ability to expand the efforts of the city to address even more difficult challenges. The Chamber, Community College, Small Business Development Center, local businesses, and school districts focus on leadership development. We work to home grow future leaders through programs such as Youth Investing Energy in Leadership, or YIELD, JC's, Young Professionals, Leadership North Iowa, and the United to Serve Leadership Symposium. Inclusion and diversity continue to be a point of focus for North Iowa, as we are a traditionally homogeneous community. However, recent workforce recruiting efforts have led to more diversity within the community. The North Iowa Corridor Economic Development Corporation engaged a local company to recruit workers from Puerto Rico to North Iowa, and this effort has already led to nearly a dozen new families in the area. Smaller communities throughout the Midwest are witnessing loss in population, businesses, workforce, and general disinvestment. We are committed to rolling back that narrative. The Vision North Iowa plan is ambitious, but with the broad coalition of organizations and leaders committed to this new chapter, much more success is well within reach. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, September 13, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Robert L. Broghammer, 1941 to 2020. Robert Leo Broghammer, DDS, 79, of Clear Lake, died Thursday, September 10th at Good Shepherd Health Center in Mason City. Per Robert's wishes, his body has been donated to the University of Iowa Deeded Body Program for medical research. A massive Christian burial will be 11 a.m. Friday, September 18th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, 1001 9th Avenue South in Clear Lake. Reverend John Gossman officiating. Interment will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids at a later date. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 17th at the church. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, masks are required at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Robert's family suggests memorial contributions to the Alzheimer's Association, St. Patrick's Catholic Church, or St. Croix Hospice, 302 North Grand Avenue, Suite 5 in Charles City, Iowa, 50616. Robert was born May 22, 1941, the son of Benjamin George and Mary Lucille Murphy Broghammer in Cedar Rapids. He married Jane A. Spritzer on September 7, 1968 in Cedar Rapids. A graduate of Campion High School in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, Robert attended Creighton University in Omaha and later received his Doctor of Dental Surgery degree from the University of Iowa College of Dentistry in Iowa City. He enlisted in the United States Navy in 1969, working as a dentist at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego, and was honorably discharged as a lieutenant in 1971. Following his service in the Navy, Robert and Jane moved to Clear Lake, where he began his dental practice and would work for 30 years, retiring in 2001. After some time off, he made the most of his hobbies by going to work at Fleet Farm in Mason City. There, he was able to enjoy socializing about gardening, fishing, camping, and hunting. He also volunteered and worked with the Boy Scouts of America earlier in his life for nearly 10 years. Robert was a member of St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Clear Lake. Robert is survived by his wife, Jane Broghammer of Clear Lake, 4 children, Robert Broghammer and spouse Tracy of Castle Rock, Colorado, Jennifer Broghammer of Davenport, Anne Beaulieu and spouse Matt of Iowa City, and Catherine Keach and spouse Robert of LeClaire. 11 grandchildren, Jordan Broghammer and spouse Alex, Ava and Caden Broghammer, Cassie Thompson and spouse Grant, Callie Glidden and Corey Askelson, Ethan, Faith, and Dawson Beaulieu, and Will and Lucy Keach. 2 brothers, Benjamin Broghammer and Frank Broghammer and spouse Paula, sister-in-law Kathy Broghammer, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, sister Mary Lou Hansen and spouse Roger, 2 brothers, Neil and Mark Broghammer, and a sister-in-law, Marilyn Broghammer. Troy D. Thompson, 1969 to 2020. Troy was born to Kay Thompson and Dale Thompson and big sister Maria on December 3, 1969 in Cedar Rapids. He died September 1st in Redmond, Washington, in hospital of heart attack, taken from us too soon. We will miss his sense of humor, kind heart, and infectious laugh, always in our hearts. He is survived by his mother, father, sister, daughters, Courtney, Allison, Brooke, Madison, son, Dylan, and 6 grandchildren, Noah, Liam, Harper, Camille, James, Adeline, and extended family. Celebrate Troy's life by donating to the Humane Society of North Iowa in Mason City by calling 641-423-6241 or going online to hsni.org. Sergeant Major John W. Roy, 1931 to 2020. Sergeant Major John W. Roy, retired, enlisted April 1948 and served 3 years with the 82nd Airborne Rangers. He served in the Korean War with Special Operations. After Korea, he was an instructor with the Ranger School at Fort Benning, Georgia until 1955. He volunteered for Special Forces and was sent to the Defense Language School to study German before his assignment to the 10th Special Forces, Germany. He served 7 years in Germany, where he became an avid skier and skydiver. He served in Laos and Vietnam with Special Forces. John retired in September 1970 and graduated from the University of Tampa, Florida, in December 1971. Later retired from the Hennepin County, Minnesota Sheriff's Department in May 1990. Preceded in death by his parents, Charles and Harriet Roy, wife, Patricia Roy, siblings, Harold Roy, Juanita Arndt, Donald Roy, Peggy Beaver, Carol Schmidt, Oliver Roy, Teddy Roy. Survived by siblings, Jane Anderson, Jimmy Roy, Pat Pope. 4 children, 4 stepchildren, 15 grandkids, and 13 great-grandkids, all of whom will miss him with all their hearts. Paul R. Clark, 1960 to 2020. Paul Raymond Clark, 60, passed away on Wednesday, September 9th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, September 15th at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, September 14th at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City. Paul was born on January 18, 1960, the son of Homer and Betty Jean Beggie Walker Clark of Rockwell. He grew up in Mason City until 8th grade when his family moved to Rockwell. Paul was a graduate of Rockwell Swaledale High School. After high school, he attended NIAC in automotive mechanics. Paul married his high school sweetheart, Pam Kuhlemeyer, in Rockwell on September 26, 1981. From this union, 4 children were born. Paul worked at Schneider Metal, IMI Cornelius, and lastly, Curry's until his retirement. Family was important to Paul, spent as much time as he could with them. Everyone could tell that being a husband, father, and grandpa brought endless joy to Paul's life. He was really excited that he just found out that he was going to be adding twin boys in February to his 4 grandsons. Paul was a longtime season ticket holder and devoted fan of the Minnesota Vikings, with a legacy brick with his name that will live on at the new Viking Stadium. Paul was a collector of sports cards and had an extensive gun collection. Target shooting was something Paul loved to do with his family. The outdoors was another passion, as well as camping and relaxing by the bonfire whenever possible with the family. In his spare time, he would watch movies of all sorts. Going to the theater with his brother Mark is something they could bond over from time to time. Paul always had a love for animals, not just dogs, but reptiles too. Zoe, his beloved dog, was Paul's little princess. She was always at his side. Paul had a love for food and was known to order the biggest or most expensive item on the menu everywhere he went. Paul was a man of few words, but humor came easily. He was known for his witty one-liners and goofy comments. He had an amazing personality and loving spirit. Paul would always put others before himself and would do anything for them. He will be remembered as a loving and caring soul. Those left to cherish memories of Paul are his wife, Pam Clark, children, Nicholas Clark and spouse Stephanie of West Des Moines, Danielle Just and spouse Matt of Cedar Falls, Jared Clark of Mason City, Mackenzie Clark of West Des Moines, grandchildren Miles and Kai Just, Briar Pierre, Calvin Clark, and twin boys on the way, siblings Peggy Reed, Mark Clark and spouse Marie, Pam's parents Dale and Janet Kuhlemeyer, siblings-in-law Rob Kuhlemeyer and Brenda, spouse Brenda, Danny Kuhlemeyer and spouse Kimberly, loving dog Zoe, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, great-nieces and nephews, and extended family. Paul is preceded in death by his parents, infant brother Stephen Clark, grandma Laura Kleinau, and nephew Nathan Andrews. Susan Sue L. Stallman, 1946 to 2020. Susan Sue Lee Stallman, 74, of Atkins, passed away at home on Thursday, September 10th, after a courageous battle with cancer. Born May 31st, 1946, in Mason City, to Leroy and Florence Venichuk Miller, Sue graduated from Clear Lake High School in 1964 and moved to Cedar Rapids in 1966. On October 24th, 1970, Susan married Terry Stallman in Cedar Rapids, and together they raised their daughter Tammy. She retired from Collins Radio, Rockwell Collins, in 2003 after 37 years of service. During that time, she was also a member of IBEW Local 1362 Union. She was a member of St. John the 23rd Catholic Church. Susan is survived by her daughter, Tammy Bruner, and spouse Sean, and one grandson, Cody, who was so precious to her. She is also survived by her sister, Sharon Peterson, and spouse Alan, Aunt Shirley Baim, as well as several brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, nieces, nephews, and cousins. She was preceded in death by her husband, parents, grandparents, brother Donald Miller, and several brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law. Private family services will be held, with private services posted on a website. To sign an online condolence, visit the website overtonfunerals.com. Memorials may be directed to the family. Margaret L. Downing. Funeral services for Margaret L. Downing, 94, formerly of Green, will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, September 14th at St. Mary Catholic Church in Green, with Father Ralph Davis officiating. Burial will be in St. Mary Cemetery in Green. Visitation will be Sunday, September 13th from 3 to 6 p.m. with a rosary at 6 at St. Mary Catholic Church. Memorials are to be directed to the family at P.O. Box 212, Shell Rock, Iowa, 50670. Please see the Friday edition for a full obituary. Harriet H. Winter, 1928 to 2020. Harriet Winter of Clear Lake passed away peacefully on Thursday, September 10th, with her husband at her side. A memorial service will be held 11 a.m. Tuesday, September 15th at First Congregational Church, 205 West 10th Street in Clear Lake, with Reverend Harlan Sari officiating. Anyone wishing to watch the service online can find it live-streamed on the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel Facebook page. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Monday, September 14th at Ward Venslight Colonial Chapel. The family encourages masks be worn and social distancing guidelines be followed. In honor of Harriet, memorials may be directed to First Congregational Church to be utilized for Operation Christmas Child. Harriet Helen Jones was born February 12, 1928, in Sioux City to Herod and Helen Scott Jones. She grew up in Sioux City and graduated from East High School. She attended Morningside College, where she earned a degree in elementary education. She met her husband, Delano Del Winter, in Sibley. They were married on June 26, 1954, and were blessed with five daughters, Susan, Karen, Ellen, Lori, and Lisa. As a young family, they lived in several states, including Texas, Virginia, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Ohio, before settling in Clear Lake in 1968. They made their home there for more than 50 years, with favorite memories including 4th of July celebrations, 25 years teaching third grade at Lincoln and Sunset schools, and many, many friends. Traveling with Dell and camping with family and friends brought Harriet joy. For many years, she and Dell wintered in Arizona and enjoyed yearly trips to Branson, Missouri, and the north shore of Lake Superior. Harriet was active and involved in numerous activities at church, including many circles and ladies' groups. Throughout the year, she loved collecting toys and trinkets for Operation Christmas Child shoeboxes to be sent to children in need. Harriet played in the same bridge club for over 20 years, where she formed lifelong friendships. Most of all, Harriet was a loving and caring wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. Her family was the center of her life, and time spent with them brought her the greatest joy. Harriet is survived by her husband of 66 years, Delano, daughters Susan Latta and spouse David of Plymouth, Minnesota, Karen Scheer and spouse Craig of Clear Lake, Lori Mullenbrook and spouse Kirk of Northfield, Minnesota, Lisa Anderson and spouse Jeff of Ames, 13 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren, sister-in-law Dolores Mao of Sibley, and 7 nieces and nephews. She joins her parents, daughter Ellen, and 2 sisters, Marilyn and Mary, in heaven. In honor of Harriet, memorials may be directed to First Congregational Church to be utilized for Operation Christmas Child. Charles W. Arndt, 1945-2020. It is always difficult saying goodbye to someone we love and cherish. Family and friends must say goodbye to their beloved Charles W. Arndt of Garber, Oklahoma, born in Mason City, who passed away at the age of 75 on August 25th. You can send your sympathy in the guest book provided and share it with the family. You may also light a candle in honor of Charles W. Arndt or send a beautiful flower arrangement to the funeral service. He was predeceased by his parents, Howard Arndt and Helen Stoltenberg Arndt, his wife, Kay Graves, and his brother, Donald. He is survived by his children, Tammy Fagan and spouse Tim, Bill Arndt and spouse Amy, Ben Arndt and spouse Carrie, Lisa Arndt and Charles Arndt Jr., and his brother, Robert Arndt. He is also survived by 14 grandchildren and 13 great-grandchildren. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, September 19th at 3 p.m. at the Anderson Burris Funeral Home Chapel, 3002 North Van Buren Street, Enid, Oklahoma. Memorials can be sent to Anderson Burris Funeral Home Chapel, 3002 North Van Buren Street, Enid, Oklahoma, 73703. Lucinda J. Gruet, 1950-2020. Lucinda Cindy J. Gruet, 69, of Mason City, passed away Saturday, September 5th, at the Mercy One North Iowa Hospice inpatient unit after a long battle with terminal illness. A graveside service will be held 1 p.m. Wednesday, September 16th, at Westside Cemetery near Marble Rock. A celebration of Cindy's life will be held following the graveside at 3 p.m. at the Mason City VFW. Lucinda Jean Wagner was born December 4, 1950, in Charles City, the daughter of Kenneth Shorty and Arlene Maris Wagner. Growing up in the Marble Rock area, Cindy attended Marble Rock High School. She was blessed with 2 children, Dave and Romy. On December 24, 1999, Cindy married Bill J. Gruet Sr. in Mason City, and 2 families became 1. Cindy was a lover of the outdoors who didn't mind getting her hands dirty in the garden. Whether it was vegetables or the numerous flowers around the house, she truly had a green thumb. Cindy was a talented fisherman and enjoyed time by the water. For many years, she played softball and later found joy in playing pool on the Mason City Pool League. Time spent cooking and baking showed off Cindy's talents in the kitchen. Most of all, Cindy loved being a caring wife, mother, and was blessed to become a grandmother and great-grandmother. Cindy has kindly asked Pete Kuroff, Nathan Lavange, Paul Gruet, Rob Mullert, Cindy Brierley, Gary Anderson, Junior Leppert, and James Munson to act as her honorary pallbearers. Those left to cherish her memory are her husband, Bill Gruet Sr., children, Dave Williams and spouse Kathy of Manly, and Romy Williams of Joyce, Bill's children, John Gruet, Bill Gruet Jr., and Jared Gruet, 12 beloved grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, sister Doris Withy and spouse Bill of Northwood, and brother Larry Wagner and spouse Liz of rural Marble Rock, sister-in-law Joan Wagner Massey and her son Richard Jr., as well as numerous extended family members and countless friends. Preceding her in death are her parents, Kenneth and Arlene, a brother, Richard Curley Wagner, a niece and nephew, Lisa Withy and Michael Withy, and a great-granddaughter, Sophia Reich. Guest columnist Bob Jensen. Fall, a good time to make fishing memories. Many anglers across the Midwest declare late September and October to be their favorite times to fish, and I would mostly agree. In the fall, the fish catching can be so good for quality and quantity. In addition, the surroundings are pretty spectacular as well. The trees are in full color and wildlife sightings can be abundant. I have many fond memories of fall fishing. In the early 80s, I lived in the Walker area of Minnesota. Walker is on the shores of Leech Lake, but there are lots of smaller lakes in the area. This was before fishing for largemouth bass was popular in the Midwest. A friend of mine had a book. I believe it was called a plat book. This plat book was a detailed map of the county. It showed all the small lakes in the area, the roads that led to them, and where the boat ramp was. Some days we would leave town in the morning and visit lakes that were off the radar. We maybe had some information about the various lakes or had seen some DNR research regarding them. We would fish a lake maybe 2 hours. If the bite was good, we might hang around longer. If action was slow in the first hour, we left, mostly through crankbaits along the deep weed line. During the course of the day, we usually found at least one lake that was very productive. Other days, 2 or 3 would be good. In the course of a day, we often fished 5 lakes. We learned so much about the differences in lakes on those trips, much of which we're still applying today. The difference today is the bass are generally bigger. Maybe the bass population has gained weight. Maybe we're better big bass anglers. I think the biggest walleye that I've caught in the state was in October, trolling crankbaits at night. I caught lots of walleyes at night when the tullaby were spawning. Walleyes that eat tullaby are generally of a larger size. It was a windy night, so the boat was rocking, which made netting the big walleye difficult. I didn't get a measurement on it, but it was long and fat. Shortly after catching that one, I hooked a bigger one and got it to the boat and got a good look at it, but due to the wind, couldn't get it in the net. The key to catching big walleyes at night is to use the biggest bait they'll hit. Start with a lucky shad. If they'll eat that, go to a bonsai or banana shad. When you use the larger baits, they'll run deeper, so you'll need to let less line out. If you're concerned about spooking the walleyes with less line out, attach a planer board. Through the years, I've been fortunate to get in on some outstanding smallmouth bass action in a lot of places during all 3 open water seasons. But there is no doubt that the best smallmouth bass bite that I've ever experienced took place just a couple of years ago on Cabotagama Lake in northern Minnesota. Local guide Tim Snyder, Mike Frisch, and I were on Cab in early October. Tim had been telling us for some time how good the smallmouth action on Cab is in the fall. We searched some offshore deeper structure with our sonar. We didn't even drop a line until we saw fish. On Mike's first cast, he hooked and caught what I believe he said was his largest smallmouth at the time. We guessed it at least 6 pounds. The rest of the afternoon, we caught lots of smallmouth in a variety of sizes, mostly on drop shot rigs, but some on jigs as well. We didn't ever go more than a few minutes without having one on. We had lots of doubles and even a few triples. Memorable. The next few weeks will provide lots of opportunities to make fishing memories. Make some of your own. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, September 13th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.